Okay, thanks, Greg, and thanks to the news team too, as we easily slide into this evening's Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city, with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, reminding you that the archives of our show are on SoundCloud and on our website, momentsunderlamplight.co.uk. And you can get in touch with me at rla@momentsunderlamplight.co.uk or lamplight@cambridge105.fm. And now, as always, I invite you to attend. This evening, we play around with some of the lines in Chant 48 of Whitman's Song of Myself, with, as usual, several digressions as they arise. But first, let's begin with something else. Here's what happened. The other day I was walking Tashi, my Tibetan terrier, along our usual paths around the village, and met one of the neighbours just going to wash her dog in the river after a tramp on the muddy hill. A few words of chat and that was it. But as I looked at her, I thought to myself how like a young girl she looked. Maybe it was the fresh air or something, but she looked more like her 8-year-old daughter, I thought, than like her usual self. Okay, no big deal. Just one of those little impressions that let's hope all of us are open enough to pick up on as we go about the day. And I try to be as mindful as I can be while walking, but the monkey mind usually intrudes, and in this instance, words started dancing around in my head. She looks like a big girl, I thought. And then the phrase big girl drew in a song with these words, big girls don't cry. You remember the Four Seasons.
Big girls don't cry, big girls don't cry.
Now, why did that song come into my head? I hadn't heard it in years. Back when I was young, though, it seemed that every outdoor summer party was accompanied by one or another of the Four Seasons songs. I wonder how those songs have stood up over the years, I pondered, and when I got home, I sat down with a pot of tea and had a listen. I attended to them. Yes, all these jukebox dramas about teenage love, which, looking back, actually carry so much more sociological and psychological significance. There's Dawn, Go Away, about the poor boy who feels he's not good enough for the rich girl and tells Dawn to go stay with him. He'll be good to you, presumably because he's going to become a corporate lawyer or head of his daddy's company and can provide all sorts of luxuries for Dawn as she settles into the socialite routine she was born into. Think what a big man he'll be. Think of the places you'll see. Now, think what the future would be with a poor boy like me. We're in some sort of very static early 1960s society, where, as this poor boy tells her, we can't change the places where we were born. And he advises her, can you believe it? He advises her to choose money over love. And then, switching it the other way around, there's Ragdoll, about the girl who dressed in hand-me-downs, and everyone laughed at her when she came into town. Presumably she lives in a shack in the woods. These are just stereotyped people, after all. But such a pretty face should be dressed in lace. Well, not the face exactly, but this is a figure of speech, called synecdoche, in fact. He means her body should be dressed in lace, rich girl's clothes. I'd change her sad rags into glad rags if I could. But, and here's the issue, my folks won't let me because they say that she's no good. Social barriers again. And so, though I love her so, I can't let her know. He loves her just the way you are, but, well, he's not going to fight social conventions. Nor are his teenage listeners expected to either. And lots of other little dramas. Working His Way Back to the Girl He Let Get Away. That's the song, Working My Way Back to You. Or after his girl says she wants to leave him, insisting that there ain't no good in our goodbyin', true love takes a lot of tryin'. Oh, I'm cryin'. So, give me a second turn in. Don't cool off while I'm burning. And, as the title says, let's hang on to what we got. I suppose that's another version of the conservatism that doesn't cross barriers. Shall we pause a minute and attend to this song? Let's hang on. It starts muted with a kind of recitativo, and then the fuzzy guitar throws us into a completely different place. Feel the energy, but also watch the way Frankie Valli's falsetto seems out of control. Here 1 minute, then gone, then back again.
There ain't no good in our goodbyes. True love takes a lot of trying. Oh, I'm crying.
That was Let's Hang On, and we'll continue, we'll hang on, we'll continue attending to the four seasons. I'm mocking the lyrics, gently, I hope, but it's really the music that made these songs hits. Catchy tunes and frenetic drumming, and as in Motown songs of the same era, the foregrounding of the bass and drums so the kids get the beat moving deep within them. And also the voices. The quartet of the four seasons with Frankie Valli's sudden shifts into falsetto. But the words, too, appeal to a certain kind of adolescent audience. There's not a lot of joy in these early hits by the four seasons. They specialize in adolescent sadness. Of course, sorrow has always been one of the main themes of songs. But with the four seasons, I think the sorrow almost always verges on self-pity. It's very noble to tell Dawn to go away, I'm no good for you, but there's a little too much emphasis on him and his pain. And although he loves Ragdoll, he can't let her know, poor thing, because, well, his parents just won't let him be with her. These songs bring out all the latent self-pity of the teenage boy. I'm not sure about their appeal to the girls. Who, at the same time that he's beginning to awake to his individuality, is also awaking to the constraints and pains of the adult world, fleeting love, social prohibitions, and so on. He's just ripe for a good dose of self-pity. Sorrow is a good thing. I mean, we all feel pain, and we need to be honest about it. But self-pity is the wrong way to deal with pain. It's focused only on the self, and it is the embodiment of what we call passive-aggressive behavior. I tell you about my pain so that you will feel bad and then do what I want you to do. And I think the self-pity comes out no more gloriously than in the song they called Opus 17, since it was their 17th single, with the subtitle, Don't Worry About Me. A typical passive-aggressive line of the self-pitying person. Oh, don't worry about me, I'll be fine. Go on, enjoy yourself without me. I'm fine, really, I am. Well, attend to the way the brassy horns and heavy drum beat pull us in from the very start. And the self-pity starts as Frankie Valli shoves the opening line at us. I can see there ain't no room for me. That's okay. Go with the other man. I'll understand. I'll be blue, and I'll be crying too. But girl, you know I only want what's best for you. Sure, kid. Don't worry about me. I'll be strong. I'll try to carry on. Very nice. But then he adds this little touch to make sure she feels guilty about it. Although I know it won't be easy when you're gone. And a very strange bridge and sax solo before shifting to another key for the next verse. Apparently, this song ties with Bobby Darin's Mack the Knife for the most chromatic key changes in a rock or pop song, modulating 5 or 6 times. Why all these key changes? Well, I asked music maven Juliet why musicians change keys, and she said, to make the music more interesting, of course. Of course. But why so many changes here? What's he trying to do? The desperation of the self-pity, I think, expresses itself most strongly through these changes, as he goes higher and higher to catch her attention, as though tugging at her sleeve, saying, notice me, key change, notice me, key change. It's either that, or his self-pity is so overpowering him so much that he's going crazy and progressively out of control. Notice that the obligatory falsetto of Frankie Valli comes only in the background of the chorus until the very end, when he belts it out only to be caught in the fade-out as the song closes. But enough of this. Let's hear the song. The Four Seasons, Opus 17, Don't You Worry About Me. I'll be strong, he wails as he fades away. Well, let's hope so. Let's hope he doesn't end up like the singer of our next song, the Statler Brothers' Flowers on the Wall, which we had to include once we started talking about songs of self-pity. No need to say much in introducing it. It's just another way of saying don't you worry about me, because I have such engaging things I can do with my time now I'm alone. Counting flowers on the wall, playing solitaire, patience, with only 51 cards, smoking cigarettes, and watching that most soporific of children's television shows, Captain Kangaroo.
About my happiness, but all that thought you're giving me is conscience, I guess. If I were walking in your shoes, I wouldn't worry enough. Are you and your friends are worried about me? I'm having lots of fun. Counting flowers on the wall, that don't bother me at all. Playing solitaire till dawn with the deck of 51. Cigarettes and watching Captain Kangaroo. Now don't tell me I've nothing to do. Last night I dressed in tails, pretended I was on the tag. As long as I can dream, it's hard to slow the swinger down. So please don't give a thought to me, I'm really doing fine. You can always find me here and having quite a time. Counting flowers on the wall, that don't bother me at all. Playing solitaire till dawn with the deck of 51. Smoking cigarettes and watching Captain Kangaroo. Now don't tell me I've nothing to do. It's good to see you, I must go. I know I look a fright. Anyway, my eyes are not accustomed to this light, and my shoes are not accustomed to this hard concrete. So I must go back to my room and make my day complete. Counting flowers on the wall, that don't bother me at all. Playing solitaire till dawn with the deck of 51. Smoking cigarettes and watching Captain Kangaroo. Now don't tell me I've nothing to do. Don't tell me I've nothing to do.
It's an upbeat song, but especially with that jangling banjo, a little too nervous. But at least they seem aware of how silly this self-pity is, and have decided to have a good time indulging in it. And with that, let's end our time with these self-pitying songs. You are listening to Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105, with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson. And now, we move along to the slightly more serious part of our evening together. Hello. Hey, here we are over in this room, getting ready to look at Walt Whitman. But there's something I'd like to look at first. A few lines at the end of the Incredible String Band's song, a very cellular song, from the Hangman's Beautiful Daughter album. The song itself is over 13 minutes long, and I've never dared play it in its entirety on Evening Under Lamplight. But we'll be looking at only the final few minutes of the track. The whole song is broken up into many different parts, which stop and start and merge together to form the piece as a whole. We're looking here at two separate pieces, which will, I hope, take us into the open-hearted resonance that Whitman is always trying to awaken us to. Here's the first part, 5 lines. Black hair, brown hair, feather and scale, seed and stamen, and all unnamed lives that live. Turn your quivering nerves in my direction. feel the energy projection of my cells, wishes you well. Mike Herron is invoking all these creatures, human beings and mammals, black hair, brown hair, symbolizing all of them, and the feathered birds and the scaly fish, not just animals, of course, but plant life, too, seed and stamen, and finally, all unnamed lives that live. Things like the amoeba, which had featured in an earlier section of the song. He asks that all these creatures feel the energy projection of my cells, wishes you well. What is this energy projection? It's some emanation from deep within us. Our spirit, some might say. It's so deep that we're usually not aware of it unless we train ourselves to be aware, and even to control our energy projection by our will. If I open to the world without judgment, without self-seeking, I can appreciate each thing for what it is, even down to all unnamed lives that live. Another word for that appreciation of things and people for what they are is love. That's what love is, after all. And so, if I look at the world around me with this love, then my whole being, down to the smallest cells, projects this loving energy. And if all things turn their quivering nerves in my direction, that is, tune in to me, they can feel this energy projection, which, being love, wishes them well. Get it? There are many ways of talking about what's going on in such moments, and Mike Herron expresses it in a hymn, which forms the second part of this section and the conclusion to the song as a whole. May the long-time sun shine upon you, all love surround you, and the pure light within you guide your way on. Maybe it's not so much a hymn as a kind of blessing at the end of the song. So, we might say that when my cells, my very essence, project the energy of wishing you well, then I have been guided by that pure light within me, that long-time sun, and the love that surrounds me. And I share it with all other creatures who, of course, share their inner light with me. This is a kind of elaboration of the concept of namaste, the Indian greeting that means the divine in me bows to the divine in you. The Bodh Gimbri underlying the words in the first part, and in the second part, the words repeated over and over, which is the style of a kirtan chanting. Well, each repetition of these lines can take us deeper. Maybe you'd say they take us into some kind of a trance-like state. And yes, why not put it like that? Though there are many different kinds of trances. I'm trying, you see, both to attend sympathetically to these lines from the song and to connect these lines as best I can to whatever spiritual wisdom I have been able to grasp myself, and also to lead us into what Walt Whitman's going to be saying. And yes, I'm quite aware that all this can easily be dismissed as flaky nonsense. It's very easy to dismiss love as soft and to cling to more practical ways of looking at the world. But remember that modern science, the great source of authority for many people today, modern science confirms that all things, down to the smallest particles, give off energy projections and interact with the energy projections from everyone else. It's worth attending to.
Black hair, brown hair, feather and scale, seed and stamen, and all unnamed lives that live. Turn your quivering nerves in my direction. Turn your quivering nerves in my direction. Turn your quivering nerves in my direction. Feel the energy projection of myself. We wishes you well. May the long time sun shine upon you, all love surround you, and the pure light within you guide your way on. May the long time sun shine upon you, all love surround you, and the pure light within you guide your way on. May the long time sun shine upon you, all love surround you, and the pure light within you guide your way on. May the long time sun shine upon you, all love surround you, and the pure light within you guide your way on. May the long time sun shine upon you, all love surround you, and the pure light within you guide your way on. May the long time sun shine upon you, all love surround you, and the pure light within you guide your way on. May the long time sun shine upon you, all love surround you, and the pure light within you guide your way on. May the long time sun shine upon you, all love surround you, and the pure light within you guide your way on. May the long time sun shine upon you, all love surround you, and the pure light within you guide your way on. May the long time sun shine upon you, all love surround you, and the pure light within you guide your way on. May the long time sun shine upon you, all love surround you, and the pure light within you guide your way on. May the long time sun shine upon you, all love surround you, and the pure light within you guide your way on. May the long time sun shine upon you, all love surround you, and the pure light within you guide your way on.
I have said that the soul is not more than the body, and I have said that the body is not more than the soul. And nothing, not God, is greater to one than one's self is. And whoever walks a furlong without sympathy walks to his own funeral, dressed in his shroud. And I or you, pocketless of a dime, may purchase the pick of the earth. And to glance with an eye or show a bean in its pod confounds the learning of all times. And there is no trade or employment, but the young man following it may become a hero. And there is no object so soft, but it makes a hub for the wheeled universe. And any man or woman shall stand cool and supercilious before a million universes. And I call to mankind, be not curious about God. For I, who am curious about each, am not curious about God. No array of terms can say how much I am at peace about God and about death. I hear and behold God in every object, yet I understand God not in the least. Nor do I understand who there can be more wonderful than myself. Why should I wish to see God better than this day? I see something of God each hour of the 24, and each moment then. In the faces of men and women I see God, and in my own face in the glass. I find letters from God dropped in the street, and every one is signed by God's name. And I leave them where they are, for I know that others will punctually come forever and ever. There's our Whitman passage. There's May the Long Time Sun Shine Upon You. Now let's take a leisurely stroll around these lines and see what's there. Whitman starts off with a series of assertions, summing up much of what has come before in this long poem. It won't do us any harm to attend closely to each of these assertions, which work almost like a second edition of the Book of Proverbs. I have said that the soul is not more than the body, and I have said that the body is not more than the soul. That old body-soul split, which leads us to despise one and pamper the other. If we value the soul higher than the body, then we will be tempted to starve the body or subject the body to all sorts of punishments, what used to be called mortifying the flesh, that is, killing the flesh, or in another direction, we completely ignore the body, grabbing whatever foodstuffs happen to be on hand, sitting around taking no exercise, but spending our time reading or even meditating, nourishing the soul but ignoring the body. I remember my dear tutor speaking on the phone to me in his 80s, telling me that his body was just a bundle of aches and pains and he could hardly walk anymore. That's because all I did for the past 40 years is sit and read, he said. He valued the soul more than the body. But similarly, Whitman says the body is not more than the soul. That takes us to those people whose body is their religion. The most important thing in their life is their diet, or their sexiness, or their exercise regimen. Or it's like a man I know in his mid-60s, very fit, who rides a bicycle furiously around the village each day, trying to get his heart rate one notch lower today than it had been yesterday. That's what matters most to him. And his soul? No, I don't even bring up that kind of subject. He wouldn't know what I was talking about and would dismiss it immediately. Ideally, of course, we need a balance between soul and body. Actually, that's the kind of thing that holistic attitudes prompt, looking at the whole self, recognizing the way that what we do to our bodies can affect the state of our soul. Not enough sleep, for instance, leading to depressed spirits and contracted soul energy. And conversely, what we do to our souls can affect the state of our bodies. Taking on the burdens of life too seriously can lead to shoulder pains, or more positively, cultivating a smiling spirit can strengthen the immune system. I'm simplifying all this terribly, but you see what I mean. It's living a life in the harmony of soul and body, and it feels healthy, as all good balance in our life does. Or as Oscar Wilde said, those who see any difference between soul and body have neither. Wilde was being provocative, trying to get his respectable readers to rise up in indignation at this blithe contradiction. But of course, there's also a truth here. If you isolate soul from body, neither will nourish the other. And for all practical purposes, you end up not having either soul or body to speak of. The next line from Whitman. Nothing, not God, is greater to one than one's self is. That sounds paradoxical, doesn't it? Myself is as great as God? That's not just paradoxical, it can be blasphemous if we don't take a moment to catch what Whitman means. Of course, it all depends on which self we're talking about. The ego self, which most people consider to be their only self, or that self with a capital S that knows its unity with all things. And if we accept that God can be found within the self of each one of us, that pure light within you, then the contradiction seems to be resolved. My soul connection to God stretches my deeper self out infinitely, and so my self is, in this paradoxical way, as great as everything there is, including God. Here's Whitman's next pronouncement. Whoever walks a furlong without sympathy walks to his own funeral, dressed in his shroud. When Whitman speaks about walking with sympathy, he means our openness to all things, feeling with them, or better, resonating with them, turning my quivering nerves in their direction, my energy projections in tune with their energy projections. If we walk around without this sympathy, we are isolated from all the life around us. We can use the people and the things around us, but we cannot interact with them. We might as well be dead. And thus Whitman shows the man walking without sympathy as walking to his own funeral. But just saying walking to his own funeral is not quite enough for an expansive poet like Whitman. He adds the extra detail that the man is dressed in his shroud, his clothes being really just a version of the winding sheet wrapped around his corpse as it is made ready for the grave. So here's our choice: sympathy or the devil. Okay, next. And I or you, pocketless of a dime, may purchase the pick of the earth. Whitman's roundabout way of putting things, pocketless of a dime, can get on our nerves after a while, unless we can read it with sympathy and enjoy Whitman's game. What's the difference between pocketless of a dime and just saying that you haven't even got 10 cents in your pockets? Well, which version makes you pay attention more? And what is this pick of the earth? The really important and rewarding things are, as we all know, priceless, not to be bought by money, needing a spiritual, not an economic exchange. I remember a friend in graduate school in New Brunswick, New Jersey, who challenged me to try doing what he sometimes did, taking the train to New York with only enough money for the train fare, and to spend a whole day in the big city without any money. What would that be like? What picks of the earth would we find? But no, I'm afraid I never took him up on that challenge. I have other things to do, I kept saying to myself. And related to this is Whitman's next line: to glance with an eye or show a bean in its pod confounds the learning of all times. There is wonder and mystery in every little thing in the world, as Whitman's been saying all along. And what's the point of the learning of all times if it does not help us open up to these wonders of the world? When, at the beginning of the scientific revolution, Francis Bacon said, "Knowledge is power," he meant that the only knowledge worth obtaining is knowledge that will enable us to exert power over the world. It is this kind of practical knowledge that has enabled us to develop all the powerful technology we live with every day. It tells us how things work, but it does not tell us the value of things. This kind of knowledge can, for instance, give us chemotherapy to help get rid of a cancer. But it is unable to tell the patient how to cope with the pains of chemotherapy, except to take more pain-relieving medicine. Nor can it tell us how cancer and chemo might work upon us to transform our whole sense of who we are or of what kind of world we live in. Such issues never arise for these people, but one could contend that they may be of more practical value than the actual knocking out of the cancer. One cures us, but the other heals us. Get the difference? That's all very well. But how do we glance with an eye or show a bean in its pod? It's not that easy to walk around mindful of the wonders around us. And here, I'm going to bring in a few lines from Robert Louis Stevenson's essay on Walt Whitman, something I perhaps should have done in earlier episodes. Stevenson is commenting on Whitman's idea of the poet as a prophet, who must wake up those people like the pusillanimi we looked at last time, those people in the vestibule of hell who never made choices. The poet-prophet, Stevenson says, must shake people out of their indifference and force them to make some election in this world, instead of sliding dully forward into a dream. Life is a business we are all apt to mismanage, either living recklessly from day to day or suffering ourselves to be gulled out of our moments by the inanities of custom. One brief impression obliterates another brief impression. There's something stupefying in the recurrence of unimportant things, and it is only on rare provocations that we can rise to take an outlook beyond daily concerns and comprehend the narrow limits and great possibilities of our existence. It is the duty of the poet to induce such moments of clear insight. He is the declared enemy of all living by reflex action, of all that is done betwixt sleep and waking, of all the pleasureless pleasurings and imaginary duties in which we coin away our hearts and fritter invaluable years. He has to electrify his readers into an instant unflagging activity, founded on a wide and eager observation of the world, and make them direct their ways by a superior prudence, which has little or nothing in common with the maxims of the copybook. Hence, a new difficulty for Whitman's scrupulous and argumentative poet. He must do more than waken up the sleepers to his words. He must persuade them to look over the book and look at life with their own eyes. This side of truth is very present to Whitman. It is this that he means when he tells us that to glance with an eye confounds the learning of all times. Back to Stevenson, back to Whitman. Notice Stevenson says Whitman has to get his readers to wake up, but he also has to get them to look up from their books, including his own poem. And that's why I keep trying to find everyday examples for what he's talking about, to shift us from the poem to the world we're living in. Oh yes, and you'll be able to find this essay on Whitman and more in our new authoritative edition of this and other essays in Stevenson's Familiar Studies of Men and Books, coming to you from Edinburgh University Press. Oh, sometime in the next 2 years, I imagine. And yours for only something like £100. The notes themselves, produced by Richard Jury and yours truly, will be worth that much, right, Richard? Back to Whitman. And there is no trade or employment, but the young man following it may become a hero. What is this hero? A great man? But what makes you great? You are great by the amount of heart you show, by how broad your breast is. Therefore, all people who throw themselves into their work and do the work for its own sake or for the sake of serving others, these people expand their hearts. And this is what Whitman means by saying that we can follow up any trade or employment and become a hero as long as we engage in it with a focused heart. That woman in, well, I won't say which shop it was, but it was in Cambridge. That woman who couldn't be bothered to help me the other day was no hero. That technical advisor I spoke to on the phone last week, who patiently listened to my problem and tried in a few different ways to explain what he thought was wrong and then waited while I tried out each attempt to fix the problem, all the while treating me more as a friend than a customer. He obviously loved his job and took pleasure in helping others. In other words, there was the real hero that Whitman is talking about. And again, there is no object so soft, but it makes a hub for the wheeled universe. That's the nature of the web. Everything is connected to everything else. and so can serve as the hub or centerpiece around which the whole universe spins, just as it also spins around countless other hubs it is connected to. I drive my car down Hills Road, for example, and my car is a hub for the wheeled universe. That car behind me has to pay attention to me so it doesn't ram into me. That cyclist I'm going past had better focus on me or there might be problems. That red light is there to tell my car to stop. Even the air in front of the car has to revolve around the car as we move aerodynamically along. But then, that car behind me is also a center of the universe, and I must pay attention to it. So is the cyclist, and the traffic light, and, well, you know what I'm getting at. You've always known it. We are all centers of the universe. The problem arises only when we think we are the only center of the universe. And as I was preparing this, look what showed up in my inbox. These words from Ram Dass. Work to extricate yourself from the illusion of your own separateness, he says. And then you do what you do in life. And as you do what you do in life, if you're a shoemaker, you make shoes. And if you're a mother, you raise your children. Whatever you're doing is the vehicle through which you express that. It's like C.S. Lewis saying, you don't see the center because it's all center. But whatever you are is the center of the whole game, and it resonates out from there. A fully conscious bus driver can affect everybody that's in the traffic around them, everybody that stops on their bus. And here's the final one of Whitman's pronouncements here. Any man or woman shall stand cool and supercilious before a million universes. Why? Why shall any of us stand cool and supercilious before a million universes? As though we were just as good as any universe around. Such chutzpah. But chutzpah is just what Whitman is advocating. Once we are grounded in our own deeper selves, lit by the pure light within us, we know we are as worthy as anything else in the universe. So much for all the hierarchies. We can ignore them, as the mystic early Quakers learned to ignore social hierarchies and paid everyone equal respect as friends. They even refused to grant the king special respect. William Penn would have referred to the king not as Charles II or Your Majesty, but simply as Charles Stuart. Then Whitman shifts from pronouncements to what we might call personal declarations, which he wants us to assent to as well. I call to mankind, be not curious about God. He means curious in the sense of anxious. Don't spend time worrying about what God is like. Don't get involved in theological debates or definitions. Instead, be curious about the world around us, paying attention to it. And if we do this, Whitman implies, we'll know as much about God as we need to. Be lowly wise, as Alexander Pope said in another context. Presume not God to scan. The proper study of mankind is man. Or as Whitman goes on to say, for I who am curious about each am not curious about God. No array of terms can say how much I am at peace about God and about death. Forget those array of terms, all those definitions. Just attend, and there's the peace about God and about death. Since who can get worked up about death when we are living in the moment? And in every moment we find God all around us. I hear and behold God in every object, yet I understand God not in the least. Nor do I understand who there can be more wonderful than myself. It's okay not to understand God in the least. In fact, we shouldn't even try. When we learn to live in the moment, it seems we automatically also learn to be patient with life's mysteries and not to be curious about solving the mysteries. We just appreciate them in the moment and then move on. And there can be nothing more wonderful than myself, since I find God within myself as much as within everything else I attend to. And so Whitman comes to his grand conclusion of the section. Why should I wish to see God better than this day? I see something of God each hour of the 24, and each moment then. In the faces of men and women I see God, and in my own face in the glass. I find letters from God dropped in the street, and every one is signed by God's name, and I leave them where they are, for I know that others will punctually come forever and ever. He leaves them where they are, as opposed to our tendency to see God in something and then grab it and take it home, or take a selfie of ourselves with it, as though we can preserve this sense of God by holding on to the thing or the image. But why hold on? Why hoard like this? We're not poor. We know, as Whitman says, that other divine things and people will punctually come forever and ever. Amen. And so may they. But this evening's Evening Under Lamplight does not go on forever and ever. In fact, we've come to the end now, and so, from me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, and on behalf of our whole community here on Cambridge 105, I wish you not only good night, but of course, namaste.